From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And coming up, we'll look at nuclear weapons all around the world with Here and Now security analyst Jim Walsh.
But first, to the talks designed to reduce the threat Iran poses of developing a nuclear weapon. There's an end-of-the-month deadline for reaching a framework agreement as the talks resume tomorrow in Lausanne, Switzerland. NPR's Peter Kenyon joins us from Istanbul before he heads to Switzerland. And Peter, you tweeted that this nuclear deal is like a new supermoon at equinox. It's huge, but no one can see it.
Yeah, basically a supermoon, as astronomers know much better than me, is at the closest point to the Earth. So it looks huge when it's full, but a new supermoon, of course, can't be seen. And these talks could be huge diplomatically. They could lead to changing U.S.-Iran relations. That could impact all kinds of issues. But because they're so sensitive, the negotiating points are mostly secret. So we know it's there, but we don't know what it looks like. And next week, they may give us some clues in the form of a framework or political understanding of what the major elements are going to be.
Well, it's something we can't see, but that's not going to stop us from asking you,
right.
You know, what we know. You know, do we know what the sticking points are?
There's differences in both substance and politics. On the issues, Iran, for one thing, wants early and robust sanctions relief, crippling their economy, while the U.S. and its allies want something less irreversible, maybe suspending some sanctions with the ability to reimpose them in case Iran doesn't live up to its side of the bargain. Officials have developed this catchphrase, snap back. They want sanctions relief that can be snapped back into place if need be, at least in the early going of any accord. And then on the politics, the U.S. at this point is looking for as much tangible evidence of progress this month as they can get. They want to show that to critics in Congress and elsewhere. But in Iran, the supreme leader has said, wait, we're not going to do intermediate or phased-in deals. The final deadline's July. Let's focus on that. So it will be kind of interesting to see what exactly they come out with next week, assuming the talks go well.
Well, and you mentioned, you know, thoughts directed towards Congress in the U.S. Republicans have been highly critical. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, of course, took to Congress to criticize the deal as he saw it so far, accusations that it was leaked. Hardliners in Tehran are making the same kinds of accusations against the Iranian negotiators that the deal is giving up too much. So can you just tell us what is the thinking from experts in the field as to where Iran is on the possibility of developing a nuclear bomb?
Well, most experts say that decision hasn't been made by Iran, but experts will also tell you that over the years, since the last effort more than a decade ago collapsed, Iran has acquired a tremendous amount of nuclear know-how. It has mastered the fuel cycle. It knows how to enrich nuclear fuel. And that's something that really can't be erased, despite some attempts to murder, assassinate nuclear scientists. So if your main concern is stopping Iran from even becoming able to know how to build a nuclear weapon, that's going to be extremely difficult. If you want to create a situation where it's very hard for Iran to make that decision without getting caught, then you've got something that might be diplomatically doable, and that's what they're aiming for.
And what do you think is going to happen next week?
I think there's a pretty good chance that they will come out with something. They'll either say, in the pessimistic view, we've made a lot of progress, but we can't really tell you much about it. That wouldn't help the U.S. side, certainly, with their critics back home. They could come out with something more substantive, something that has some numbers in it, some issues in it, some tangible steps. And that might give these talks the kind of momentum that they need to buy time for the next 3 months of grinding drafting process, where they have to write it all down, get the technical details right. And that certainly will be every bit as tough as what we've seen to date.
And what does the Obama administration say to critics who say that there shouldn't be any deal at all, that it's impossible to trust the Iranians?
Well, certainly a lot of people hold that view. I mean, even one of the negotiators reported to Congress that deception is in their DNA at one point. But the return argument to that is, well, what's the alternative? We've seen what happens when you walk away from the table. Iran built 20,000 centrifuges and put them into operation. They started enriching uranium to 20%, much closer to weapons grade. The 20% is now all gone because of this interim deal we have. And if we can get something like that, only longer lasting and stronger and verifiable, that might be worth trying for.
This table that we can't see that everyone's gathered around, Russia, China, Britain, Germany, France also there. Do they have the same interest as the U.S.?
Not exactly, no. Every country has their own national interests, but Russia and China really want to do business with Iran. That's important to them, and that might happen if there is a deal. And at the moment, keeping Iran from getting a bomb seems to be the number one concern. But as we get closer to a potential deal, we'll have to watch those dynamics even more closely.
Yeah. NPR's Peter Kenyon, who will be watching, he's in Istanbul now, but on his way to Switzerland, where the talks on Iran's nuclear program will resume. Peter, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome, Robin.
Well, amid all the conversation about Iran's nuclear program, we wanted to take a broader look at nuclear weapons all around the world. The U.S., of course, is the only country that's ever used nuclear weapons in war. But in 2009, speaking in Prague, President Obama envisioned a different future.
I state clearly and with conviction America's commitment to seek the peace and security of a world without nuclear weapons.
A world without nuclear weapons. Jim Walsh is Here and Now security analyst. He's with the Security Studies Program at MIT. Jim, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
And let's say at the outset here, the countries we know that have nuclear weapons are the U.S., Russia, the U.K., France, India, Pakistan, North Korea, China, and Israel. Are there any others?
Well, South Africa once had nuclear weapons and gave them up. In fact, if you step back and look at the broader pattern of nuclear history, it's really a shocker, one that most people don't know. The rate of proliferation, the pace at which new countries have joined the nuclear weapons club, has declined. It peaked in the 1960s when China, France, and Israel joined, and in every ensuing decade, fewer and fewer countries have joined. More countries have given up nuclear weapons beginning in the 1990s than have acquired them.
Well, what about the U.S.? Because that's President Obama was the one who said he wanted a world without nuclear weapons. We look at the U.S., it's got about, 1,700 nuclear warheads deployed, another 3,000 or so estimated in its arsenal. How is the U.S. doing on trying to reduce the number of nuclear weapons in the world and in the U.S. for that matter?
Well, it should be said right at the top that this is not only an Obama aspiration, it is international law. The Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, this thing we always talk about when we talk about Iran, not only prohibits countries from acquiring nuclear weapons, it obliges those who have them to give them up. And so how are we doing? Well, I would say Obama's done pretty good, not perfect, but pretty good. The New START Treaty took the strategic warheads, the really big intercontinental ballistic missile types, down to about 1,500. They would have gone further, cut them by another third to 1,000, but Russia didn't want to play ball. So that's a big accomplishment. On the downside, we continue to pour money into the triad, continue to pour money into modernization for weapons that will probably never be used.
Well, and does it matter if you bring it down from 5,000 to 3,000, let's say, if each country still has enough to obliterate the other if they want to?
I think it does matter, and it matters because the only way we can make progress is if there's international cooperation on this. In fact, the parties to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty are going to be gathering this year, and they're sort of angry at the weapon states that they haven't made more progress. They say, you keep asking us to do stuff, you don't do anything yourself. So unless there is some progress, even if it's not all the way to zero instantly, it helps build the political consensus that allows us to build a better and stronger regime.
Now, President Putin in Russia said he considered putting Russia on nuclear alert over the conflict in Ukraine. Is there a real threat that Russia would ever decide to use a nuclear weapon in any case?
You know, it's really hard to imagine that happening. But let's be clear. You know, I just mentioned this meeting that's going to be happening up. You know, we're moving forwards in the United States. Russia is moving backwards. It's waving its nuclear weapons around. It's threatening them, using them, flying planes and subs and all the rest. I think that really undermines that political consensus I just mentioned that we need if we want to continue to have a system that prevents the spread of nuclear weapons.
What about China? It only has about 250 nuclear warheads, but its defense budget is increasing every year, and nuclear expansion is one of the reasons.
Well, I think it's one to watch. You know, traditionally, they've had a small arsenal. They adopted what was called a minimum deterrent. While the U.S. and the Soviets were building tens of thousands of nuclear weapons, they kept a lid on their arsenal, and they adopted a policy of no first use against something neither the superpowers did. Hmm. Now, that might have been because they were poor and weak. And now as they're getting stronger and richer, that could change. I think we're going to keep an eye on that, but that's yet to be determined.
Now, as you look at the other countries with nuclear weapons, you have the rivals India and Pakistan, but you've also got, of course, North Korea. What is the most concerning country with nuclear weapons to you at this point?
Well, I would say India, Pakistan, only because They're rivals that have fought three wars. They share a border. There are terrorists all over the place. Terrorists from Pakistan almost tripped a war earlier, and which could have conceivably gone nuclear. It didn't, but you don't want that to be happening. Obviously, North Korea is a wild card, very hard to guess there. But I think most of my colleagues worry about India-Pakistan.
The one we haven't talked about, of course, is Israel, which is very worried, more worried perhaps than any other country about Iran getting a nuclear weapon.
Yeah, Israel's had nuclear weapons since 1966. Again, in some ways, this sort of victory that no one anticipated. Despite getting nuclear weapons in the 60s, we've had no other states in the Middle East acquire nuclear weapons, which is great. There is this process called a weapons of mass destruction free zone in the Middle East. That's the little engine that might address that issue in the future.
Jim Walsh, here now, security analyst with the Security Studies Program at MIT, talking with us about nuclear weapons all around the world. We'll link you to a chart about this at our website, hereandnow.org. Jim, thanks as always.
Thank you.
This week, colleges start sending out acceptance and rejection letters, sealing the future of young people. Hogwash, says our next guest. The thinking that getting into your first choice school or an elite school determines your future is not only not true, it's cruel. A 2014 report from Gallup and Purdue agrees it found no difference in workplace engagement or well-being between grads of state schools and those who went to the top-ranked schools in U.S. News and World Report. And New York Times columnist Frank Bruni would add, those rankings in U.S. News, well, again, hogwash. The title of his new book is Where You Go Is Not Who You'll Be. He joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you quote William Derezowitz. He wrote the book Excellent Cheap. We've had him on this program. He writes about an admissions process squatting like a dragon at the entrance to adulthood.
Right.
Just devouring young people. Just give us the overarching here. What is wrong?
Well, what's wrong is that we're giving kids who are blessed enough, and we need to say that, kids who are blessed enough to be looking with a guarantee of going to college, we've given them the message that getting into the most exclusive schools, going to schools with acceptance rates of below 15% or 10%, that's going to be a guarantor of success or an insurance policy against failure. And while certain schools can absolutely be advantages in certain ways, life is much more complicated than that. And we're filling kids and parents with an incredible amount of anxiety, all predicated on an oversimplification of the world and of college.
Well, there's so many false narratives here. You looked at the Fortune 500 and CEOs of companies. You looked at the Senate. What did you find?
I found that there was no pattern to where successful people went to school. So I looked at the top 10 corporations, and then I looked at the CEOs of each. Only one Ivy League school. When I looked at the whole top 100 in the Fortune 500, fewer than 30 of those top chief executives had gone to undergraduate institutions, that make the heart race.
Yeah.
And it's pretty much the same in the U.S. Senate.
In fact, you say that people might fare better if they are rejected from their first choice school, because something happens. I mean, you tell us stories of people who then want to try harder and actually feel they did better than they would have done had they been accepted.
What happened is they ended up learning a resilience that they might not have learned so early on because of that disappointment. What happened with some of them is they found themselves on a stage that was less crowded with overachievers, and they found a confidence that they'd never had before.
Give us an example.
Well, I remember this one kid I talked to. He's from the very beginning of the book. He went to a high school in the suburbs of Chicago in a very rich area. He was telling me about a friend of his in high school who was ranked near the top of the class, and she went off to Yale. He was ranked, maybe in the top 33%, very far down. Didn't even get into the state schools he wanted to go to. Ended up going to Indiana University, which was like his fourth or fifth choice. But once he got there, maybe it was because he was blooming a little bit later in life, which we forget that people do, he suddenly was getting A's in courses. He was inducted into a special honors program in the business track. He ended up getting a job out of school with the Boston Consulting Group, which was one of those Cadillac management consulting groups in Chicago. He looks up. And who's joined him there but the woman who went to Yale? They had traveled different paths, his much less gilded, to the same destination. And right now, he's finishing up an MBA program at Harvard.
You mentioned this student was in the 33%. Students who were in the top, had done everything right, hired consultants. There's one consultant you profile who charges $50,000, starts working with kids when they're in ninth grade.
There are many consultants that fit that profile. It's a booming industry.
But the point is, you can do that and do everything right and do all the volunteering and all the everything they tell you to do and still not get into the top schools, which might be even more shattering
because they're tethering their self-worth to whether they attain those goals. Some of these schools have acceptance rates that are so low. Stanford last year set a new precedent. Only 5.1% of applicants were accepted. When you think about what that means in terms of any given kid's odds, especially if that kid is not a legacy case, is not a star athlete, is not a standout musician, is just – a phrase I use in the book is just generically outstanding, which sounds like, you know, it was oxymoron, but – that's not enough anymore.
Well, the system's so rigged as well. You point out that some schools will buy the names of prospective students from the SATs and then recruit them like crazy to lure them to apply so that they can turn them down and have a low acceptance rate.
Absolutely. Schools are ginning up desire in order to frustrate it. And they're doing it because a low acceptance rate is bragging rights. You know, if Stanford posts an acceptance rate of 5.1%, you can bet that Harvard and Yale don't want theirs to be anything over 7.5 or 7 because they'll look to the outside world as if they're inferior to Stanford, which is, of course, ludicrous. We've let top schools become regarded as handbags. You know, you want the Prada. You don't want what you can pick up at Walmart. Education is so much more important, so much bigger, and yet we're turning it into a luxury product that people compete for.
Talk about some of the schools that have such interesting programs and are so overlooked. There's actually lists of overlooked colleges.
My favorite example is actually Arizona State University, and I'll tell you why. Arizona State is enormous, something like 75,000 students, and it has an image, a caricature, as a party school, which I'm sure it does much to live up to. But Arizona State University also has an amazing undergraduate honors college where students are learning from a caliber of faculty that matches up against any school anywhere. I profile a couple of students who went through ASU and got extraordinary educations because they were at a large state university with the scale and the resources and the amount of money where that's possible. They just had to insist on it and be a little bit more proactive, which in and of itself was a great part of their education.
Monmouth University in New Jersey has a behavioral psychology course that takes place with the sea mammals at Six Flags Great Adventure. St. Norbert College in Wisconsin has a relationship with the Green Bay Packers where kids can study the business of sports. Just some of the unique programs and schools mentioned in New York Times columnist Frank Bruni's new book, Where You Go Is Not Who You'll Be, An Antidote to the College Admissions Mania. Frank himself went to private high school, Loomis in Connecticut, had his heart set on Yale, but didn't want his parents to pay. Then he got a big scholarship to the University of North Carolina. He went, and he says it's an experience he wouldn't trade for the world because it got him out of his world into a new one. But Frank, there may have been one trade. Tell us about St. John's in Annapolis and Santa Fe.
Oh, St. John's College is a college that's after my heart. It's a shame to me that when I was in a very kind of elite prep school in New England, I never heard or had suggested to me St. John's College. But it is a place that's dedicated to great books. It doesn't do tests so much as it does papers and student-teacher conferences. I mean, it's almost like a kind of literary salon elevated to the level of a college. And yet again, this is a school we don't talk about because we're too busy talking about the known brands.
But Frank, you know, there are going to be people listening who hold on to the narrative that's been written that if you don't get into one of those schools, it's like if you don't get up that rung, you know, on the ladder, you don't meet the young person who might then later in life help you grease the skids into his father's company on right. Wall Street or something. You know, there's
That may be true. It does work that way for some people. But we have so exaggerated the size of that advantage. You and I have been out in the workforce for a good long time. Mm-hmm. We know that once you pass the age of 25, certainly past the age of 30, no one asks you any longer where you went to school. I think if we send the message to kids that their school's name is going to do the work for them in life, we actually may have created a disadvantage for them because that's not going to be true 10 years down the road.
Well, it might be true that the fact that you went to Harvard might be important in certain circles, but you also point out those become very closed circles.
They do. You know, you're not getting something you might get at a state university where you're going to be encountering a much, much more diverse socioeconomic group of people. And part of navigating the world and even getting ahead in business is being able to deal with all sorts of different people.
And it works in different ways. Howard Schultz, of course, the CEO now of Starbucks, was a Jewish kid from Brooklyn who went to Northern Michigan University in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
That's right. And he will tell you he learned quickly how to be nimble around people he didn't immediately understand, how to, you know, win friends and become a leader in an environment that wasn't immediately familiar.
Frank Bruni, were you surprised at how many former college presidents and deans of admission hate the system the way it is now?
I wasn't surprised, but as we talk about it right now, it makes me sad because they want not to be lashed to it the way they are, but too few of them are taking the steps to disentangle themselves. It's an arms race of sort, you know, an arms race for prestige, and nobody wants to lay down his or her armaments unless they see everybody else doing it. And so it's going to take people of a bit of independence and courage to get us out of this.
Well, I'm thinking that this is a great read for families that might are trying to get out of it, but it's also a great read for families who maybe thought they never had a place in it. There are so many schools out there.
The truth of the matter is, it's a rare college that can't give you an extraordinary education. The fact that you maybe don't have an immediate purchase on or inside track into one of these vaunted colleges isn't as much of a millstone around your neck as you think it is, because you're honing a scrappiness that other people aren't, and you're still going to be able to find a home at a school that can do wonders for you if you carry the right attitude into it and if you carry the right attitude out of it.
That's Frank Bruni. The book is Where You Go Is Not Who You'll Be, An Antidote to the College Admissions Mania. Frank, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
A fragile ceasefire has allowed life to return to some semblance of normal in some areas in eastern Ukraine. The BBC's Tom Burridge reports from Donetsk.
In a packed theater hall, the antithesis of gunfire or shells falling. The sounds this elderly audience in Donetsk have endured for months. And the fact that it's Russian singing ringing out around the auditorium is music to their ears.
We want freedom from Ukraine. We want to speak Russian. We want to be good neighbors to Russia. My name is Ludmila. I am an instructor at the university. I used to be, because I'm now a pensioner. I have lost a lot of friends because I want to be with Republic, and a lot of people, some people, they want to be with Ukraine. But all those votes which were taken in our region, they told that most of the people, they want to be closer to Russia than to Europe. Russian people, they always were our supporters. But Europe, they want to serve America.
You don't want to be part of a Europe that's allied with America.
No, I don't want to be better to be close to Russia, you know.
From opera to tanks. Soviet ones that are being repaired by pro-Russian rebels who claim they seized them in battle from the Ukrainian army.
So this factory is absolutely full of armoured personnel carriers and tanks. You can hear the workers hammering away at parts. They say all the parts are just taken from other vehicles, so some of the tanks here have been completely stripped down.
Меня зовут Павел.
Your name's Pavel.
Мы восстанавливаем трофейную технику.
We repair trophies, vehicles, and then transfer it to another place.
You call them your trophy vehicles?
Как бы да.
Yes.
Do you think these vehicles will be used in battle in the future?
Я думаю, да.
Yes, I hope, yes.
For now, though, there's a ceasefire, and it's generally holding.
This is the late morning market in Debaltseve, a town north of Donetsk that only 2 weeks ago was the scene of fierce fighting when it was taken by the rebels. Driving in, a lot of the buildings are badly damaged. But superficially, at least, this scene is one of near normality. They're selling bags of small fish and cured sausages like kebabs. But as of a fortnight, this town is situated in the self-declared Donetsk People's Republic.
During months of fighting, most of the young have left this region, a place which, well before the war, had a strong connection with neighbouring Russia. But as the tanks get rebuilt in Donetsk, do those in power on both sides really want peace? Or is the lull an opportunity to rearm? Regardless of their politics, what people living here will applaud is if this permanently replaces the sound of shelling.
The BBC's Tom Burridge reports. You're listening to Here Now.
Let's turn now to an opera edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. We are joined by Peter Van de Graaff, who hosts the Beethoven Network out of WFMT in Chicago. It's distributed all across the country. He's also an opera singer himself, by the way. Peter, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Jeremy. Good to be here.
And one of the things I must say that's going to be difficult about this DJ session for me personally is we're going to be pronouncing a lot of names that are from all over the world. This is something you have to do every day, but let's give it a shot here and get right to the music. This is Horch die Lerche singt im Ein. Am I right on that one? From the Merry Wives of Windsor. This is composed by Otto Nicolai and sung by the German tenor Fritz Wunderlich with the Bavarian State Orchestra. Let's listen. Beautiful voice there. Tell us more about this piece.
This is, they talk about desert island recordings. I think this piece with this tenor is what I would take with me if I could only have one piece in one, in the whole world. He has this incredible purity of sound. It's a passion. It's so clear, distinct. I think he's the greatest singer that's ever been recorded. He had a tragic life. This is a 1963 recording. He died at the age of 36 falling down some stairs right before his Metropolitan Opera debut. And so there's not that much recorded of him, but Fritz Wunderlich, for me, is the greatest of the greatest.
And what is he singing about here? Tell us about this piece.
Well, this is from The Merry Wives of Windsor, and it's just, it's a setting of the Shakespeare text, Hark, Hark, the Lark is Singing in the Meadow. He's in love with the soprano, not surprisingly, and it's a song singing about reminiscences of their love and their time together, and so well set, I think, by Otto Nicolai.
Okay, well, let's get to another one. This is Alleluia. This is composed by Handel with Russian soprano Yulia Lezhneva singing. She's accompanied by the Il Giardino Armonico Music Ensemble from Italy.
That's the word. She's a young soprano, pretty much new on the scene, but has this amazing agility. She can do whatever she wants with her voice. Now, I should say that this is not an opera. This is actually the setting of a single word, Alleluia, from a motet. And she doesn't do a lot of opera either. She mostly does Baroque music, obviously. She has kind of a thin voice, but it's incredibly accurate and incredibly agile.
And what do you like about this piece so much?
These motets are sacred motets. And most of them end with that single word, Alleluia, and it's a chance for the singer just simply to show off, and I think she does so in a brilliant way. I wanted to include that recording.
Okay, well, you also wanted to include a piece from the French opera Manon. This is A Fouiller Douce Image. It's composed by Jules Massenet and sung here by the German tenor Jonas Kaufmann with the Prague Philharmonic Orchestra.
Sure.
See, this is why I wanted to do an opera DJ session. It's just so amazing to listen to.
It is. I'm choosing the best of the best. You have to remember here, Jeremy. I think this guy is the greatest singer singing today of any voice type. Jonas Kaufmann. He's very handsome, too, by the way. He's a great actor. I remember the first time I heard him, I thought, who is this baritone? Which is, of course, a lower voice part. He's not a baritone. He's a tenor. He has the richness and beauty and, again, the power and diction, sort of like that Fritz Wunderlich we heard earlier, but there's a richness to the sound that Wunderlich doesn't have.
Well, here is another amazing voice, and somebody who's actually been on our program before, Renee Fleming, and you wanted us to hear My Flowers by Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov. Here is Renee Fleming singing with the Mariinsky Theater Orchestra from St. Petersburg, Russia. What an incredible voice. And Peter, Renee Fleming, by the way, is an American opera singer. She is the first American opera singer that we've heard in your selections today.
That's a good point. There's a lot of great American opera singers today. I think she is one of the very, very best. There's just that rich, creamy sound. She can do anything. And she's also a wonderful actress with her voice as well as on stage. And I love how she sings that particular aria, which is a completely unknown aria from an unknown work by one of my favorite opera composers, Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov.
Well, it's just a beautiful piece, and we have time for one more. This is Hound Open Wide Your Jaw. This is from the opera Hercules by Hermann Raupach, and it's sung here by the Italian mezzo-soprano Cecilia Bartoli with the I Barocchisti Baroque Ensemble out of Italy and Switzerland.
Живущих устрашает, мою то славу украшает, мою то славу украшает. Пойдут мы солнечным местом, вступлю и встревожат.
Ending this DJ session with a bang, Peter.
Well, it's a funny recording because it's a German composer, Hermann Raupach, writing in Russian. He was writing for Queen Catherine the Great, Italian mezzo-soprano, Cecilia Bartoli. The thing I love about Cecilia Bartoli is, first of all, her curiosity. She finds such amazing, unknown repertoire. But then again, you take her technique, the passion of her singing. This comes from a disc called St. Petersburg, completely unknown singers that wrote for Catherine the Great, and very, very interesting and very worthwhile repertoire.
Peter, you have been singing and listening to and playing opera on the radio for decades now. What do you think continues to make this kind of music so compelling?
I'll tell you a little secret. I used to hate opera. I mean, hate it.
Really?
When I was a kid. I would run to the radio and turn it off when it came on. Then I started singing it, and I came to realize that this is the great art form. It has everything. It has orchestral music. It has singing. It has the visual arts. It has dancing often. It has acting in it. It has everything. You put it all together, and there is no more compelling experience in any theater, I think.
Okay, well, I'm going to put you on the spot then, since you do sing opera. Can you give me a good segment ender here? You're listening to Here and Now?
My engineer's telling me, for a fee, I'll do that. Sure. let me get in touch with my agent. I'm going to back off from the microphone. This is Here and Now. How about that?
That's fantastic. Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
If you're a regular public radio listener, you've heard a StoryCorps conversation and maybe shed a tear or thought, wow, how long has it been since I talked to my mom, dad, mentor? Reporter David Isay started StoryCorps. 11 years ago, he built a booth where people could go and have intimate conversations with the help of a facilitator. Thousands of conversations are now archived in the Library of Congress. Last year, he was awarded the TED Prize, a $1 million grant to create something he wished to see in the world. Today, he's revealing that wish. An app that lets anyone in the world with access to a smartphone record a conversation and submit it to the StoryCorps archive. David Isay joins us from New York. David, welcome and congratulations.
Hi, Robin. Thank you so much.
So this was the realization of your 50-word wish for humanity, which you submitted to TED, and you got this grant. What was the wish?
We wanted to figure out a way to expand StoryCorps so people don't have to come to a booth. So basically, we created an app, which is a digital facilitator. Remember, the facilitator is the person who's in the booth with you when you have this conversation. And we tried to replicate that person as much as you possibly can in an app. So basically, you download this thing, and it walks you through how to have a StoryCorps conversation. And then at the end, you can hit a button, and it'll upload it directly to the Library of Congress.
Imagine that. I mean, here you're somebody who, you know, for decades lugged around recording equipment, and here it is in the palm of the hand that people can do this. And we've looked at the app, and some of the questions that are suggested, what do you feel grateful for? What makes such good friends? And you've expressed in the TED Talk where you think this might be able to go. For instance, a national homework assignment for American kids.
Yeah, so that's actually a dream of mine. I think we're going to try and do this. And that is that over Thanksgiving, and I'm not sure if it'll be this year or next year, what we're going to do is see if we can get every kid who's in a U.S. history class in high school to interview a grandparent, someone of an older generation over Thanksgiving so that in a single weekend, an entire generation of Americans can be honored in this way, can be listened to in this way. And then also what it means, StoryCorps has always been a U.S. project. And as of, you know, today, it's an international project because obviously people can use this all over the world.
Well, let's listen just to a little bit of one of those conversations just to remind people. This one you played at the TED Talk. You'll hear the audience in the background, but it's between a mom, Sarah, and her son, Josh Littman, who has Asperger's.
Did I turn out to be the son you wanted when I was born? Like, did I meet your expectations? And
you've exceeded my expectations, sweetie, because, you know, sure, you have these fantasies of what your child's going to be like, but you have made me grow so much as a parent because you think...
Well, I was the one who made you a parent.
You were the one who made me a parent. That's a good point. But also because you think differently from, you know, what they tell you in the parenting books.
Yeah.
I really had to learn to think out of the box with you. And it's made me much more creative as a parent and as a person.
I just love that conversation. Just two of the thousands of voices, you know, so powerful. They make us just sit and stop and think. And David, I wonder, do you worry people are going to be sending their recordings straight to the Library of Congress? I almost worry that it will almost be like a new Tower of Babel and the voices will almost be lost. Yes, the recording and having the conversations is important, but who's going to listen to all of this?
You know, I that's a problem I hope we have. You know, honestly, I think that creating the technology, that's the easy part. It's getting people to use it, which is the hard part. The dream with this app is that we just, you know, basically collect the wisdom of humanity. And, you know, if you have interviewed your mom, then you'll have that and your kids will have that and your grandkids will have that. So, you know, my concern is much more whether people will kind of have the courage to pick this thing up and have these, you know, frankly, intense, sometimes difficult, always meaningful conversations.
This all started for you, interviewing started for you when you were 22 and your father came out to you as gay. And you say it was shattering for you at the time because it changed everything you thought you knew. He then also told you about the Stonewall riots, which launched the modern gay rights movement. You went and found the young men involved. You did extraordinary recordings. It just sort of helped launch your career in a way. But just staying with that moment when you had that conversation with your father, as you say, a difficult conversation. Tell people who might be afraid, you know, afraid of that intimacy, what happens on the other end after you've gone through the difficult part?
Well, you know, it's in some ways these StoryCorps interviews have something in common with hospice and death and dying in some ways. And there's a great hospice doctor named Ira Byock who wrote a book which was called something like The Four Things You Want to Say Before You Die. And it was basically thank you, I love you, forgive me, and I forgive you. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, I think that's what happens in the StoryCorps booth. And it's a chance to have a sense of closure with people who matter to you and to say the things that are important. And, you know, that's kind of why we're alive, you know.
David Isay, the founder of StoryCorps, their new app comes out today. We'll have all the information at hereandnow.org. David, thank you so much.
Robin, it's great to talk to you.
Jeremy, David will not stop until everyone on earth has told their story.
Well, in fact, whenever I go and speak to high school or college classes about journalism, I always play
a StoryCorps piece because they are such great radio.
What a great idea. He says, and I think a lot of us agree, when you hear someone's story like that, it's like being on holy ground. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.